Have you ever wondered what it's like to take a few weeks off, a few months off, and take the trip of a lifetime to dive into it and see how it'll change you? In today's episode, I talk to Will from goingawesomeplaces.com, where we discuss a lot of his experiences traveling from renting cars and driving in other countries, to sipping on amazing wines in Niagara, to eating some of the best ramen noodles that you could ever have in Tokyo, Japan. And we dive into a little bit about travel hacking and what it's like to get free flights and try to take advantage of the extra opportunities to just travel more. Let's get started. Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Nomadic Foodist Show, a podcast for the food and travel obsessed. My name is Chris, your host, and I help people discover amazing food all around the world. Today's conversation is with Will from goingawesomeplaces.com. It is a blog about his adventures and travel guides and travel hacks so that everyone can really enjoy their time abroad and try to make the most of the time that they have when they're on vacation, when they're traveling. We had this great conversation. We just jump around to a lot of different topics, and we talk about and focus on the themes of trying to make the most of your time and money when you travel, whether it's trying to find the time to get off, you know, from work and trying to have these maybe longer experiences and how rewarding they can be. I know my entire life, I've barely had any time for travel and vacation, and I still fit it in when I could, but it wasn't until I spent a good chunk of time, weeks off, and traveled the world where I understood for myself, like, okay, this really is an experience that everyone really needs to have. Will and I discussed this topic just a little bit and tried to uncover a little bit about how more people can have these sort of experiences and to be adventurous when they travel, to take those risks and understand that being uncomfortable is okay. Goodness, we talk about renting cars in other countries and some of the tips that he has for those like myself who are a little intimidated by going and renting a car, trying to figure out the driving laws and regulations and trying to make sure that they have a safe trip when they're trying to travel around a country with their own motorbike or rental car. It was just great to kind of pick his brain a little bit because he just has a lot of experience in that area. And with travel hacks and getting free flights, I mean, who doesn't want a free flight, right? We dive around in that subject where he has a lot of experience from his background as a consultant and traveling around the world and figure out ways to rack up those points and so that, well, you can get free stuff. And we kind of go into his methodology a little bit, and he gives his tips so that anyone can sign up for these sort of travel credit cards and get these reward packages and startup points so that you can just go. It's all about making sure that you can extend your time traveling and have the best possible experiences because you don't want to waste that time, for sure. So here is my interview with Will from goingawesomeplaces.com. Will, thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm very excited for our conversation today. Please, let's start off with an introduction. Tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about your website and blog.
Yeah, so my name is Will from Going Awesome Places, and it's been quite the journey. I've been doing this for over 10 years, and it really all started back in 2012 when I quit my job in consulting, decided to, you know, really last minute start a travel blog. Didn't really know what I was doing, but it was really meant to let my friends and family know what I was up to because I was going to be backpacking through Asia. And since then, it's kind of evolved into becoming a much bigger blog to include not only just the blog, but, you know, YouTube channel, social media as well. But for me, my passion has always been around like outdoor adventure and experiential travel. That's kind of areas that I focus in. But as well, I've kind of really developed and honed my craft. And, you know, something that I'm also really passionate about is sharing really detailed itineraries and travel guides. I think a lot of that comes from my engineering background and my work as a business slash technology consultant. So obviously doing something very different than what I was doing in my previous life. But I think a lot of those things translate through. So So yeah, no, it's I can't believe it's been 10 years and I currently do this full time. So it's been quite the roller coaster ride.
Yeah. I mean, starting off a travel blog and taking that deep dive to full time can be quite the endeavor for sure. And I know I'm on my journey there to do that myself. But let's just rewind a little bit here and revisit. It's kind of just how you grew up. I find that most people, whether they traveled a lot or didn't, really affected how they looked at travel as an adult. So how did you grow up and how did those early years influence your outlook on like food and travel?
Yeah, that's a great question. For sure, I think our upbringing and our earlier years really dictate kind of how we view the world and how we eventually kind of get into the space that we are in now. In my case, travel blogging and really focusing on travel and food, of course. I'd say like a lot of it started very early on with my parents. We used to do a lot of road trips, a lot of these bus tours as well. And that's what really allowed me to see a lot of Canada and kind of the East Coast USA as well. And we used to travel a lot. And I think that's where I first got a taste of travel, although I didn't really understand it quite as well. It wasn't really until in university that I got a chance to do an exchange semester. So 4 months in Sweden. And what I tell a lot of people that's really what changed things for me. I think learning about independent travel and learning how to live on your own abroad really opens your eyes and kind of forces you as well to kind of make it all work. And as we spent those 4 months, you know, we were in class, but also a lot of time not in class. We backpacked all around Europe at the time. And so that's what really opened my eyes to travel, you know, my passion for it. And I think that was really the spark plug for everything that kind of happened afterwards.
Your family road trips. I want to go to that really quick. I find that family road trips, including my own, sometimes could be good and bad. I'm glad that they kind of like wet your whistle a little bit to what travel can be. How were your family road trips growing up?
Yeah, for sure. Like they're always the ups and downs of family road trips. And, you know, they were great because we got to see so much. And the way we traveled back then was really about like seeing as much as we could, driving a lot of, you know, quite a bit of distance away from, you know, I'm based in Toronto, Canada. And so, you know, we saw a ton. And it was very like sightseeing focused. And I appreciate that, but I think kind of what you're alluding to as well, like you learn that, you know, you kind of decide like, okay, what's going to be my travel style? And I always knew that I wanted to do things a little bit differently, whether it be kind of the family road trips or a lot of those bus tours that we used to take and realizing that, oh, I don't know if that's really for me. I really wanted to do something on my own and really be able to, you know, craft my own itineraries and be able to do the things that I wanted to do, not necessarily just the sightseeing, but getting to do certain excursions or activity-based travel. And certainly on the food side as well, I think that was very lacking from the road trips that we did back then, which mostly consisted of, you know, McDonald's and you know, not necessarily the best places to eat in the cities that we went to. So I think over the years, that has definitely resonated with me in terms of, you know, wanting to travel in my own way.
Yeah, I've figured for myself, you know, doing the whole family travel thing, it really does give you an idea, like, these are the things I like, I'm going to keep doing these things, but these things I really want to do differently. When we did some family road trips, it was not very food centric at all. It was very much, we packed a lot of our own food. My mom would just like bring like a whole bag of like oranges and apples and grapes and sandwiches. And then that was to save money too. But one of the things that broke my heart, I'm like, oh, I want to eat at these cool, fun places. And we occasionally did, by all means, like we did, but it wasn't quite like, I guess what I wanted. I always wanted to try all the places and eat all the things and see all the things too. But they're still good. I love road trips. Do you still like road trips now?
For sure, yeah. No, when my wife and I get to go on trips that we get to rent a car and really get to drive around, I think about our travels to Ireland, Iceland. Those are some fantastic road trips. I mean, just having the freedom to go wherever we wanted, to stop wherever we wanted, and spend as much time in certain places or kind of drive through places that weren't as interesting to us. I think that's super liberating. And to see, I think the big part of it for us with road trips is like to not only like the urban centers, but like really to get out to the countryside, really get to meet locals, to be able to explore different places that not a lot of people get to see, and kind of stumble upon places, which is always the most exciting part about travel. So yeah, we've always really loved our road trips.
I'm really intimidated to rent cars in other countries. I have not done it yet. I have rented one motorbike in Vietnam, and we got into a small accident. So ever since then, I'm like, I'm not driving in another country ever again. What are some of the things that you do to, I guess, keep yourself safe and, I don't know, have the courage to drive in these other countries? I don't know. I'm just not quite there, I guess, yet.
It could totally be a bit of an adventure, especially when you're driving on the other side of the road. I
Oh,
think,
yeah.
you know, when I first did it in, I think it was Australia, you know, I think we the first 5 minutes I curbed the rims because
Yeah.
I just was not aware of how close I was, my body position relative to the car, relative to the road on the other side. Things didn't match up, let's just say. So it's definitely something that you get better at for sure. It can be very nerve-wracking driving on a different side of the road or even a different country. In Ireland, let's say, like the roads were very narrow. Let's say you're going around the coast, the highways, or just the streets that you're traversing through. Especially with large lorries or big trucks that kind of pass by the other direction, it does get a little bit scary. But I mean, I think travel kind of opens you up to being comfortable with the uncomfortable, I guess you could say,
Yeah, I understand that.
to like just really embrace it. And I guess I have a personality of just like working with it, like whatever comes my way, I'll deal with it, and staying cool, calm, and collected. I guess is a positive trait that I have. So been able to make it work, and luckily no big accidents. But I can definitely relate to having a scooter. I think we had one in Taiwan, and we drove around that we had like you know 5 minute lesson from the gentleman that was renting these, and we were off.
Oh man.
And so I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, when we rented the scooter in Vietnam, there was no lesson except for here's the brake and here's the gas and good luck. So do you have any tips for people who are really trying to, I guess, rent the car, rent a vehicle and in these other countries, and by other people I mean like me.
Well, insurance is for sure a good idea. And so that could be with your credit card, using the right one that has kind of car rental coverage. Paying for insurance is definitely something that you should do most of the times for sure. I think about our trip to Iceland, and they just have very different coverage because of the terrain. Being very aware of you know going off road, which roads you're allowed to drive on. But from an insurance perspective, that was a trip where I knew that I wasn't gonna you know cheap out, so to speak, with insurance. So we got the full coverage to make sure that you know if you know there's volcanic ash that blows on your car and causes some damage, that we're safe, right? So yeah, definitely doing your research ahead of time is key, and drive carefully, being aware. I mean that's I mean that's kind of a given, right? Whether you're driving at home or internationally. And the last thing is like being aware of things like, do you need an international driver's license? It's not every country requires it, but for instance, I think it was in Greece. where we rented a car, we did need an international driver's license. So we had that on us, and we had to get that at our local, in Canada would be CAA, or in the US would be the AAA. Super easy to get. But it's a good thing that we did the research and knew ahead of time.
Yeah, driving carefully, I know I laughed, but it really is true. People can be very aggressive drivers, and I've seen some crazy things on my road trips across the United States. And I hope if people were to drive in these other countries, definitely take your time. Don't be aggressive. Don't try to rush through lights or stop signs and stuff like that. Like, definitely err on the side of caution. Like, take your time. You don't have to breeze through everything and then just hope for the best. And because it's unfamiliar territory, you don't quite know the laws and everything. I actually just drove someone the other day, and this isn't to scare anybody about renting cars or scooters in other countries, but he had just gotten back from a trip to Tulum, Mexico, and they were renting a car. They're driving around the city and stuff, going to the beaches, and he actually went down a one way, the wrong way. So he went down the road the wrong way. He got pulled over by a police officer there, and the police officer was like, "I'm going to give you a DUI because I can tell you've been drinking." And then he basically like paid off the officer a couple $100, and the officer said, "Okay, you can just go on your way." So there's some things you got to consider. Definitely take your time. Because if he hadn't gone the wrong way, then he wouldn't have been pulled over and all these things wouldn't have happened. And who knows? He could have been really drunk. I don't know the whole story there. he was just retelling me this story, and I was telling him, like, yeah, I don't drive in other countries anymore after the motorcycle accident. So yeah, take your time and understand too, I guess, the implications of if you do get pulled over, what could happen? Or if you're into an accident, what could happen? I'm going through all the details. I'm type A, so I have all this like checklist of things I have to consider before I rent a car again.
Sure. Yeah, totally. Yeah, and not to dwell on this topic too much, I have so many different stories about this. But one thing that came up to mind was that, you know, travel certainly looks very different now than it did, you know, 10 years ago when, you know, I was dealing with printouts of Google Maps and like instructions how to get where. I think now it's so much easier with, you know, once you have data on your phone, you know, you have the maps and directions from, let's say, Google Maps to get from A to B. I think that makes a huge difference, because I just remember before then just being completely lost or making the wrong turn and not having the benefit of GPS now that says, like, you know, please turn around or, you know, find an alternate route, right? So exactly. So yeah, having that is important. And the other story I have is from South Africa, and has to do with police as well. So luckily we did our research. We were tipped off from a friend that, you know, especially if you're driving from, let's say, Johannesburg to Kruger, there's actually a lot of speed traps, and a lot of, you know, police, unfortunately, that are looking for a payoff, essentially. So we made very sure to stick to the speed limit there. And that was something that, again, just through research and knowing ahead of time that, you know, this was something to be wary of. And luckily we were okay. We didn't get pulled over good, by anybody. And so we were safe.
Can you just remember maybe one of your favorite moments or experiences where the road trip was really essential and without it just wouldn't have been as fun, and it really just helped for you to enjoy that location or that city?
I mean, so many places. I mean, we've talked about a couple so far. You know, Iceland is such an incredible country to go around, and you couldn't do it on foot for sure. You know, you could stay, I guess, in Reykjavik, but then you'd really only be seeing a very minuscule part of, you know, the true beauty of Iceland. So to have a car there, you know, being able to, we drove down to the southern side of Iceland. We also drove out to Snæfellsnes, which is a peninsula on the west end of the island. And again, just being able to do it at our own pace and be able to pretty much drive anywhere we wanted to get to the viewpoints, to get to some of those hike trails, having the freedom, like I said. So there's certainly many places in the world where, like, you almost have to do it as a road trip. Like, it just really wouldn't be the same if you did like a bus tour or if you tried to take public transit. And a lot of times they just don't exist, right? So Iceland's a great example of a very road trip centric trip.
Yeah, I was considering doing Iceland last year and really did a lot of research into the whole road tripping thing. And you mentioned insurance and like the volcanic ash like causing a problem and like going on some dirt or kind of like off-road kind of roads too. Like I remember reading about making sure if you know you're going to be going on a little bit more of a rough terrain to get the extra 4x4 kind of insurance too, which means like there's a lot of adventure ahead, it seems, throughout the entire country.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But it's incredible. You got to go. It's definitely one of my favorite places. And I feel like we only saw maybe a quarter of the island, even through our, 8 days there. So definitely would love to go back.
What was like your favorite thing that you did in Iceland that really stuck out to you?
I think one of the coolest things is just because of there's so much geothermal activity on the island. Yes, there's places like Blue Lagoon, which you might have heard of. It's like probably the most popular kind of spa slash hot spring place. But just naturally occurring, there's a bunch of hot spring areas around the island that are really off the beaten path that you kind of need to hike to, or locals have built kind of a makeshift pool with change rooms and things like that. So there are a couple of those that we went to that were just so incredible. Like we were literally in a valley somewhere surrounded by mountains and snow. And we were there in this natural kind of pool, just soaking it up. And it was very off the beaten path and very different from that Blue Lagoon experience, which we did as well to contrast and compare. But that's something that was quite memorable. Just something that was quite unique to Iceland.
Well, thank you for sharing your thoughts on driving in other countries and Iceland and everything. Mostly that was for that was for me and my benefit. So if anyone listening finds benefit from that too, that's good. But I want to go back a little bit to when you talked about going to Sweden for 4 months. What was it like? Was that your first time out of North America?
I had done family trips before internationally, but obviously, with my parents and that being a very specific style of travel or visiting family, let's say, internationally. But this was the first time, I would say, in Europe. Yeah, this was my first time in Europe, going to Sweden and completely on my own. Although I kind of lie there in that, like, there were a lot of my classmates that also went. So,
But apart from family, apart from your parents though, that's pretty important, especially when you're younger.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And it was scary. It was, you weren't sure how things were going to go. I mean, luckily I had a bit of a support system out there. But, whether it was figuring out classes and getting settled in into a new apartment, getting my bike and having to bike around pretty much everyone, getting used to that because, we don't really do a lot of that here. And learning a bit of the language, but really getting to know the international student community there. And then it was like the excitement of like, oh my gosh, like the world is our oyster here. Like we should travel Europe, right? Since we're out here, we got our big, huge backpacks and, we're itching to go somewhere. And, we definitely took full advantage. We passed all of our classes and luckily with the university we were at, it was the beauty of internet, exchange is that for us anyways, it was just a pass fail mark. So it honestly didn't even matter. And in Sweden, the passing grade was the bar was much lower than ours in Canada. So there was not a lot of pressure. So it was kind of the best scenario for us. It was a difficult semester if we were to do it back at home. But it was perfect. It was perfect. I recommend it for everyone. Everyone I talk to now is going to school. That's like the number one thing. Like you have to do an exchange semester. It's life changing for sure.
How old were you
at that point? 20, like I can't remember the exact age, like 20, 22 or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I agree with you. If you are in your early 20s or you just got out of high school in the United States, and I have tried to encourage so many people, and this is one of my biggest regrets, was not spending a semester abroad, doing some sort of exchange program, anything at all to see another country, or even just getting out of your own state, if you're in the United States, in your own city, because people live differently in these other places, even if it's just in the same country, but just on the other side, and how people eat, how people talk to each other, how people build relationships. And to take advantage of that when you're young, when you have very low responsibilities. I don't know. I felt like my 20s were a bit wasted. I was too serious. I was too focused on graduating and, you know, getting a job and making money, and which is a very good thing to do. It's very responsible. I mean, by all means. But I felt like my 20s, I could have spent more time adventuring and finding out a little bit more about myself. And when I have friends who are in their, you know, early 20s, I'm like, it's okay to be figuring yourself out, to, you know, spend a semester or two abroad. We actually have a friend who spent, goodness, I think 2 years over in Hungary because she saw that we were traveling and she was so intimidated. She's like, I don't know. I've never been outside the United States. I don't know what to do. There's this foreign exchange program I was just thinking about. I'm like, me and my wife were like, sat her down. We said, you have to do this. Like, you have to do this now. Now's the time. You're 23 years old. Like, you have very little responsibilities and it goes toward your college credit and everything. And she went over there for 2 years, had like the time of her life, learned so much about herself and goodness, the world. It's like, how could you not take advantage of that time?
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. It'll change your life. I mean, you know, aside from, you know, college or university really teaching you the foundations and, you know, the education side of things. But I really felt that, you know, for me as a person, like I truly developed just even though it was only 4 months, but, you know, you learn so much, like you said, just seeing how people live and picking up on a lot of the small things or just how the world works, as opposed to kind of being stuck in your own bubble. So being able to get outside of your own bubble, being uncomfortable and learning that, like, hey, I can do this, right? And I think is that confidence that really allowed me to be confident in traveling, but also just like, you know, being a human being.
Yeah, it's okay to be uncomfortable. You get in some weird circumstances and situations when you're traveling a lot. And I'm sure through your experiences around the world, you've been in some very interesting circumstances and situations, for sure. And that's part of the fun. That's actually what makes some of the best stories, I guess, you know, like, well, this is a really weird thing that happened, or this was kind of scary, or, you know, I didn't expect this interaction to turn into a good friendship. It's just part of travel that I think we lose touch when we get too comfortable in like one place.
Yeah. And the last thing I'll to say about exchange is that, like, you really only kind of have that one shot to do it, right? To do a foreign exchange, not foreign exchange, but like to do an exchange semester. I loved it so much that, you know, late in my later years, I guess, after school and working and things like that, it's like, man, I'd love to have that experience again. But it's just not the same anymore. Like once you're out of the world and, you know, you have a career and things like that, as much as you want to kind of have that experience again, relive it, time has kind of passed and things are just different. So I encourage everyone who's kind of at that stage, like to seriously look at it, because it's really special.
So after that whole experience in Sweden, when was like your next really big trip or like travel experience?
So I kind of went down this interesting path, you know, I studied engineering, but got into kind of the more business side of things. And I became a consultant, a software consultant, right? And as a consultant, if you've ever watched, is it Up in the Air or?
Yeah.
It's Up in the Air, right? So I lived that lifestyle. I was literally George Clooney, living out of a suitcase, going from client to client. And most of my clients, were in the US. So I was constantly traveling from Toronto to, you know, Miami to Los Angeles to Detroit to, you know, everywhere all over and in between Milwaukee. I kind of got to scratch that travel itch a little bit through that work because it allowed me to really get to explore a lot of these cities in the US. Even though they're like, you know, really short hits, like being out there for work, but also kind of trying out different restaurants or like going to a really cool museum while I'm out there. So that allowed me to kind of continue to do that. And I really got into photography, and that kind of translated through to what I do today in blogging. But yeah, that was a very specific type of travel. And then through that, I think I realized I wanted more of that. But I also knew that I wasn't cut out to be a consultant forever, right? You hear from other consultants that you eventually burn out. And it's very true, because like, it's funny, because love the travel, but like I was almost on the road too much. I was never home. And I mean, you're basically working constantly.
Yeah.
You don't have weekends. At the time I was working 5-day work weeks on the road in the US, come back home for a day to do laundry. Sunday afternoon, you fly back out to the next city. So it was, really taxing in that way, as much as I enjoyed it. So I was like, appreciated the travel, but I wanted to kind of do it properly, like not just as kind of that up in the air lifestyle.
Yeah, I was always curious about that. I always thought maybe I should get into a business where I could travel a lot and travel for work, and they'd pay me to go on planes and all that sort of stuff. But then, yeah, you're right. It can just be you're working all the time, and then what's supposed to be kind of enjoyable is just, I guess, a drudge. You know, you have to go on all these planes and you don't stay in one place for very long. And up in the air really, I guess, depicts that for a lot of people who are just business travelers, and they're never at their own apartment for very long.
Yeah, absolutely. I will say though, that was, that opened my eyes to a lot of the travel hacking that I do now. So, once you become kind of a consultant, like you become obsessed with like points. And so whether it's collecting airline points or hotel points and getting the right credit cards, like everyone, you know, in the organization is always talking about that kind of stuff. So that really sucked me in, and I've definitely been able to take advantage since then. So wasn't all bad for sure. Like it was kind of a great, great career to kind of have coming out of school and really, you know, getting to do that travel and then realizing, okay, what do I want to do next? And that's kind of what led to, you know, Going Awesome Places.
So how did you start off Going Awesome Places, and with travel destinations, which ones were like your first ones that you went to that you wrote about and you were excited to share with the world?
So it's a great segue, because, you know, I did my time as a consultant, you know, I think it was like 4 years roughly. And I got burnt out, and I was like, I can't do this anymore. And I wanted to travel. I wanted to also kind of maybe do my own thing. And so I took a leap of faith and decided, okay, I'm just going to quit. I'm going to plan this kind of 2 to 3 month backpacking trip through Asia and see what happens. Right. It was a huge gamble. I didn't really know what was going to happen. And like I said, the blog started as a bit of an accident. I was meeting a friend kind of right before I was going to leave for Hong Kong. That was my first destination. And they asked me like, hey, are you going to start a blog? I'm like, oh, didn't really think about that. And then the same night I looked up, I started thinking about domain names. And then I was doing a bit of research, like what should I, you know, I ended up starting with WordPress. Did the customary like hello world posts, which I've since deleted, but that was my first post. And it was a very different style of blogging, at least in my mind. I just didn't know what I was going to do with it, but like I said, I wanted to let people know what I was up to, mainly friends and family. And I used to also have kind of a photo blog as well. There are these other sites where you could upload your photos because I was really into photography. But I wanted another way to tell these stories. So I thought, okay, well, since I'm going to be gallivanting through, you know, Southeast Asia and kind of the other parts of Asia as well, that, you know, I would just kind of do like a diary style thing. And I think for a lot of bloggers of my generation, I guess you could say, like, that's how most people started, right? Like it was very diary style. I did day to day, talked about like what I did and the experiences that I had, and a great way to post my photos as well. So Like I was going through it for a couple months. I think I was probably most excited about, after Hong Kong, we got to go to Bali, and be able to share those stories, going to the rice fields, the monkey sanctuary, like a lot of things that it's funny. Like I thought Bali was over touristed back then, but I didn't know where it would go from that point. This is 2012. And it's funny that, I look at Bali now, it's like, oh my gosh, it's changed so much. And I thought it was touristy back then, but now it's like a whole other level, right? But I got to see it kind of in a bit more of a different kind of different state than how it is. But yeah, it was great. We had a local guide, and a lot of those things will stick with me for sure.
Yeah, the rest is history, as they say.
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, you brought up something that I kind of struggle with a little bit is going to touristy kind of spots. Because I mean, I like tourist destinations. Like some places are touristy for a reason because they're amazing and they have so many things to offer. But sometimes I may skip over something because it's super cool to go there and everyone's doing their Instagram pictures. I don't know if that's like the right mindset to have. I mean, I'm decently well traveled. I've been to 25 countries. I've spent a lot of like slow travel time too, but I actually skipped over Indonesia and Bali because I'm like, man, all the Instagrammers are going there. I don't really want to have to, I don't want to be involved in that. Maybe I should go somewhere else. We did a long trip through Southeast Asia, and yeah, Bali was kind of on the list, and like Indonesia as a whole. And we're like, it just seems like a bit overcrowd, a bit extra for us. We'll come back another time. What do you think about that? I don't know. Is that the right mindset? I don't know what to do or how to handle it sometimes.
It's tricky, yeah. Yeah, and that's what I was kind of alluding to, that if I were to think about doing a trip to Bali, I'd really kind of have to think hard about whether I would want to go, right? Just because it's so there's so many people there now, that I mean there's so many of these co-working spaces, and people working out of Bali, and yeah, it's just a very different vibe, especially with Instagram on the rise and everyone wanting like those picture perfect shots. That said, I'm certainly guilty of that too, and wanting to get, like, as a photographer, like I want to get those incredible photos, right? But yeah, no, I think you're right. It would be part of the calculus for sure. Like, okay, I have a bunch of places I would love to go to, and where am I gonna like really enjoy it, right? Or am I gonna feel like going to this place is just out of necessity, out of FOMO, that like it'll be, oh, cool, I saw it, but then actually I really enjoyed this off the beaten path place, right? I think a great example I have is a trip in 2019 to the Greek islands. So I was traveling with my wife, and I'd actually backpacked through Santorini back in 2006. So again, many years have gone by since then, right? And Santorini itself has changed a lot since then. When you could literally watch a sunset in Ia, like just around a bunch of other backpackers who, brought some wine and cheese and were singing songs and stuff like that. But you couldn't do that today. But I kind of warned my wife. I was like, I think it's very different now, and like it might not be what you think it is. It's still very beautiful for sure. But here's how we're gonna plan the trip. We're gonna go to a bunch of different islands. I want to really see the kind of the dynamic range of the Western Cyclades and various islands. And so we did a bunch of islands, Milos, Paros, Folegandros, Santorini as well. And the funny thing is that, I asked her afterwards, like, what was your favorite island? And we had debates about this throughout. But ultimately, it was like the island that nobody's ever heard of, like Folegandros, right? The
Oh,
island.
okay.
An island that not a lot of people get to. It's it felt like we had it to ourselves, and we had our little ATV to be able to drive up and down the island. We got to meet locals. There was a little small town that we had like incredible meals at, and that was that. Yeah, we just love that more than, I got stunning photos from Santorini, and we did the sunset in Ia and everything. But yeah, it just wasn't quite the same. And so I get it. Yeah. So back to your question, like, oh, do you, yeah, struggle with that for sure. Like if I were to go back to the Greek islands, yeah, if it wasn't wanting to show my wife because she really wanted to see it, that I don't know if I'd go back to Santorini. I'd probably want to explore kind of these smaller islands that don't get talked about.
We were in Greece actually this past year. It was the first stop on our trip through Europe, and we got there and we were debating which island to go to. Same sort of thing. There are quite a few to pick from, and Santorini was, goodness, it was so expensive. We were looking through Airbnbs and hotels. We're like, let's go to a lesser known one. So we did some reading, and my wife found one called Syros. And nice. it's kind of like the island where a lot of Greeks go to for vacation, you know? So we went there and barely any tourists really. And it was such a good time, very good food, beautiful island, very welcoming people. And we're really happy with our choice. And it was, goodness, a quarter of the price too for everything. So I don't know. I'm glad you mentioned specifically the Greek islands, because I feel like now I didn't miss out on anything really too much.
Yeah, for sure. You probably got way better value, it sounds like. Still incredible sunsets. They happen on all the islands, really. Probably had way better food and, weren't surrounded by tourists. I mean, I know with, these past 2 years, it's been a little bit different, but with our trip to Santorini for that sunset, we literally had to camp out at a spot two-ish hours before, just to be able to kind of watch it. And I took some, pans on my phone and on my camera as well, just like the crowd. And it was just a wave of humanity that was just all there to watch the sunset, and people coming from off of buses and just massive crowd. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is totally not how I remember it to be, back in 2006. But things have definitely changed.
Yeah. And that's not to like put down people who travel and everything who are tourists. Cause like I'm a tourist. A tourist is anyone who doesn't live in that country, and tourism is a really important part for a lot of destinations, a lot of cities, because a lot of revenue comes in. It's just sometimes, people are the good and bad things when it comes to everything in the world. So when it comes to traveling, having too many people, it just gets so crowded, the prices go up, and then all of a sudden you think you're going to have a certain experience, but then it kind of changes a little bit. You're like, oh man, I'm kind of let down because, people are trying to scam me on the streets, and all these people are just crowding up every single shop and restaurant. I couldn't get anywhere. I can't find any good food. I can't do anything without spending a ton of money. So that's the unfortunate negative side of tourism too. So it's just trying to find that balance can be a bit of a challenge, and something that I've tried to encourage other people to do too. If you're going to a popular destination, that's great. Just consider, is that like what your expectations are versus what the reality is going to be?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. So one, balance is totally key, especially when you're putting together an itinerary. That's kind of how I construct an itinerary. But going in with the right expectations. So a lot of my writing, I guess, is to hopefully set the record straight of, here's what it really is like. You should probably watch out for pickpockets. In Athens, make sure your backpack's in front of you, because you never know, right? I actually lost my phone in Athens. So a lot of interesting stories, but just overall, going in knowing what it's going to be like, and then so that when you're experiencing it, you're not going to be disappointed. You kind of know what to expect.
I got kind of let down by Athens a little bit. I don't want to dive into that story. I've actually had another podcast guest who lives in Athens, and she told me some great stories, and it makes me want to go back and give it a second chance. But Athens was not my most favorite experience, because my expectations were kind of off a little bit. So don't want to dive too much into that, though. I do want to go into a little bit more of your personal travel stories, and especially recently. So over the past year, have you done any traveling, and where have you been?
So you're talking about pandemic times?
Yeah.
So not a whole lot, to be honest. These past 2 years have been interesting in that I've really kind of shifted focus to local travel, which in some ways has been really great. As Canadians, we kind of have this bad habit of like not wanting to really, you know, discover our own country. We always want to go somewhere else. But these past 2 years has allowed me, you know, I'm in Ontario, our province of Ontario, really focused in on our province and getting to go to places that I never would have even, you know, thought to go to. So spending a lot more time, let's say, in the Niagara region, not just Niagara Falls, but some of the other smaller towns, I guess you could say, and discovering local businesses, boutique wineries, really awesome, like B&Bs and things like that. Or going out to like Oxford County and discovering the dairy capital of Canada. And being able to hang out with alpacas, going on an alpaca walk and just doing something very different. So like our travels have certainly been very different these past 2 years. I certainly miss a lot of the international travel, but have been super grateful for, you know, all the things that we've been able to do locally and being able to make connections with, like, let's say the local tourism boards and things like that. So it's been good. I think the only like time I got to leave the country these past 2 years was a trip out to California. So I did do that last September to be able to go out to Yosemite and Mammoth as well. So yeah, no, that was a good trip. So that was nice. But yeah, not a whole lot else.
Hey, that's okay. Local travel, it really is a blessing in disguise in a way when you're forced to travel around areas that are close to you. And you're not the first person who's mentioned it where like, I wouldn't have never taken the time to travel in my own country or state or city as well, if it wasn't for the pandemic kind of shutting off all the other options. I'm like, okay. And I have to say, my wife and I, after our trip through Europe, we stopped in Montreal for 2 weeks. And I was really upset because Montreal is right next to the United States and it's probably one of the best food cities I've ever been to in my entire life. I'm so mad at myself for not going sooner. So I'm excited after my interview with Raymond Kua, who is in Toronto and who you know as well.
Yes.
it's like, man, I got to go to more Canadian cities and go eat, because what in the world? How is the food so amazing? And as an American, I've been to so many cities and states. I'm just like, this just puts us to shame how good like you guys have just got together.
I'm glad that's the case. Yeah, no, Montreal's a great city. We were just there actually on our most recent trip, just for a couple day layover. But we have such a diverse offering. Just you could get food from all over the world, whether it's in Toronto, like cities like Montreal, Vancouver, just really top notch. Excellent food for sure.
So through Canada the past 2 years, let's try to dive into just a few details of a few highlights, a few stories from what you saw and experienced, and how your expectations were met or not met or exceeded. I'd like to hear some more about Canada a little bit.
Ah, where do I start? I think because of a lot of the work that we did for the Niagara region, I kind of draw on that. I mean, there's just so much more to that part of Ontario other than Niagara Falls. As incredible as that is as a natural wonder, the speaking of food, food and drink, the wine that comes out of that region is so incredible, and you can go from, you know, different vineyard to vineyard, and everyone will kind of focus on different varietals, and you know, you speak to the winemakers and they talk about the terroir. It's evolved quite a bit over these past 10 years. It truly is, if you love wine, like, you have to go to the Niagara region. And not only just some of the bigger ones like Inniskillen or Jackson Triggs, but some of the smaller ones as well, like Trius, and some of the other ones, Henry Pelham. There's so much to do, and I love being able to hop to these different wineries during our time there. Breweries and distilleries are popping up as well, so like everyone's getting super creative, which I really love about that region, getting to know some of these makers. And a lot of that translates to the restaurant scene as well, right? A lot of folks are maybe coming back after their experience working in restaurants in the US or internationally and coming back home and starting their own restaurants. The food is incredible. A lot of farm to table, which I know is becoming and is a big thing. It's very much true in the region as well. So there's a lot to offer in that Niagara region. So yeah, we focused quite a bit of time these past 2 years there.
I know this might be putting you on the spot. Was there like one wine that just like blew you away that just made you like a convert of like, okay, this place is like amazing wine region? Was there like one wine that did it?
Henry of Pelham has this Bacco Noir, and I'm not a wine connoisseur, so yeah. I wish I could speak to it more, but it was just a type of wine that, you know, we'd never had before. And I was really impressed because normally, you know, we are very much like a white wine drinkers, and we really, really love the sweeter wines as well, Rieslings. But the Bacco Noir just had this, you know, whole new level of complexity and just very different. And they're best known for their Bacco Noir. So yeah, those kind of discoveries were just really cool as we explored the region.
Yeah. No, with wine, goodness, if that was me, I'd be like, tastes grapey. I like it. with wine, I am not very good. I wish I could dive more into wines and learn more, but there's so much to learn. Goodness. And
the nuances just, and like yeah. to be able to, it's because I interviewed for some content I created, you know, winemakers talking about their process and their journey and just the way they're able to eloquently speak about, you know, the flavors and equate them to kind of food that we recognize. It's just incredible. Like the palate that they have and be able to recognize all that, it's mind-blowing.
Yeah
and it's something that I don't have. I feel like when I talk about wine, you know, if I'm shooting a video or something like that, I'll have to do my research ahead of time, like what are the right words to say about this wine, you know, like just to be able to describe it properly other than like it was good.
Last night my brother-in-law came into town and he took us to my wife and I to a really nice dinner. And we got this really nice bottle of wine. And, you know, the waitress goes, are you going to be the one tasting it? I'm like, sure, I'll taste it. And that there's a whole process behind it. But my wife was like, what do you think? I'm like, yeah, tastes good. You know, like it tastes delicious. That's the best I can do, you know? And I don't know. Even as a food, you know, traveler, and I'm working on my food writing and everything, sometimes just like, it's just delicious. And that's all that matters. It's just surprisingly good. Don't know what it is, what's making it taste so amazing, but it's just fantastic. And you should try it too. So,
totally.
So with food in general, your travels around the world, is there a specific city that really just blew you away, really impressed you with their style of food and the dishes you tried?
I would say Japan. When I think about food and I get severe like wanting to go somewhere, it usually comes back to like, oh my gosh, we had such incredible food in Japan, and I want to go back so bad. If they would open their doors, I'd be there tomorrow. You know? It's just I think what it is about Japan for me is that like, as I've been able to go quite a bit more and try more restaurants and try more different styles of food. And just one thing I've noticed just with Japanese culture and Japanese cuisine is that like the amount of care, precision and mastery that goes into everything they do is ridiculous. Like not only just in presentation, but in the preparation and the process. Like I could watch these, you know, masters, literally masters, work, you know, if I'm sitting at the bar, and it's just mesmerizing. But that's something that I appreciate a lot, and you don't see it with other types of cuisine, I guess. Maybe I'm wrong in that in saying that, but
no, I agree.
It's kind of crazy.
Well, it's just like you said, the mastery behind it, and I'm right there with you watching them cook. It's like almost like watching a robot in a very artistic, swift form, because every single body movement has been carefully, I guess, and meticulously mastered from making tempura to cutting sushi to shaking the water off ramen. And it sounds like a basic thing, but when you watch someone make ramen, they do it the exact same way every single time. And how their body moves to shake off the water, it's like very, very precise, like oddly precise. It's just, and you watch them do it over and over again when you're behind the counter, you're like, these guys really do want to master every aspect of making this dish for me. It's crazy.
Yeah, they don't kid around. And you're right, it's like watching a performance. Like it's robotic and like it's repeatable and exactly the same every time, but it's like you watch them, you know, go from, you know, the ramen noodles to like the egg and the precise use of these long chopsticks to place the scallion on top or the tasu that goes on top, the pork. I'm hungry already. About that. But to answer your original question, yeah, it's about Japanese food. And we went 2019, and I think one thing that comes to mind is that because I did a feature on kind of the top ramen places in Tokyo, and with the help of somebody named Ramen Beast, the lover of ramen, he took us on this 2-day crazy adventure of having 4 bowls of ramen each day. It was quite a bit. If you've ever had like a large bowl of ramen, to do 4 of them in a day. So we did 8 in 2 days. It was kind of crazy, ambitious, but it was all for the sake of, you know, the content and research. So we did it, and we tried so many different styles of ramen. And again, that's, I think, what really reinforced the idea, like, wow, that just, again, the mastery, just how good they are at what they do. And then on top of that, it's the very different styles that can be, that exist within each type of, you know, of the Japanese cuisines. Like, let's say it's just ramen in this example, just like different regions having their own different style, yep, their own different mm-hmm. flair. You know, maybe it's spice levels. It's the different broths that, you know, a chicken broth is done very different from, let's say, a pork broth. And we went to a place that specialized in just beef. And hearing from our guy, just the process that they go through just to prepare that, like each single piece has to be perfectly mastered for this to work. So we did the whole range, and I'm sure we didn't try all of them for sure. There's so many more different styles. And everyone from like, you know, a hole in the wall place to somewhere that's gotten, you know, a Michelin rating or Michelin star at some point. So like really good food out there.
What city were you in?
Tokyo. And this is Tokyo. Just Tokyo.
Yeah.
I mean, you could, there's, I forget what the number is, like thousands of restaurants in Tokyo. So you could literally just spend, you know, months there just trying all the food. And you wouldn't have been able to touch like Osaka or, you know, going to food in Kyoto or like other regions as well, like all around the country.
Yeah. So. A good comparison for at least Americans to understand is like barbecue. In America, barbecue is different in Memphis from North Carolina to Texas to Alabama to even how a lot of places do it in California to up north in northern parts of like New York and stuff. So each region has their own specialty, their own unique way of doing things, and their own way of mastering that style of barbecue. And so all over Japan, just multiply the barbecue amount by like 50, and you have like 50 different like styles of ramen all throughout Japan based on which region that you're in, and a lot of times what city that you're in that region too, because it can vary from city to city. So ramen in Tokyo, yeah, I'm right there with you with just how delicious and amazing it is. Mastery of the craft. Was there one ramen place that in your mind that you can remember that just really stuck out to you? I know, like, trying to pick out the one restaurant. I'm not sure if you got to look it up or anything, but I'm not sure if there's you can remember.
There's one that I remember. It's called Kikembo, and they specialized in like spicy ramen. Like, this is like your mouth numbing type of spice. And I can't remember the exact number. Like, they use like a collection of 18 to 20 different spices, and you can choose the level of spice that you want. We didn't get the full spiciness because I think that would have burned our mouth off. But I did like, okay, a decent amount of spice. And it was just the complexities, and it wasn't just like a hard hitting spice. Like it came in gradual stages. Eventually your mouth starts getting a little bit tinglier, but it's the it's so flavorful and just packed with, you know, taste with the noodles and the pork and all the different ingredients, the bamboo shoots, all those things kind of come together really well. And that was memorable. And on top of that, the ambiance. So it's very different from traditional ramen places, where I find it's very warm, a lot of bamboo or wood, warm colored wood, sometimes brightly lit, compact places. This one was very different. It was black, it was dark, and it was just playing taiko drums the whole time. And you'd see these masks like on the wall, representing, I think, different characters from the underworld, right? So I felt like I was being transported to, you know, a very dark place to have this like really spicy
be
ramen.
Ready.
yeah, it was no joke. But that was certainly very memorable.
What was the name of it again?
Kikambo.
Funny.
With a K?
Yeah. So I actually had a guy named Brian McDuxton who has the blog Ramen Adventures, and he actually recommended that if you're going to go to Tokyo, that is one of the places you should for sure check out. So I'm glad to get a second thumbs up as listeners. If you go to Tokyo, Kikambo is must have, especially if you like the spicy, delicious foods.
Oh yeah. Okay. I'm glad I'm not the only one. So that's great.
Yeah.
Confirmed.
What's one other destination, if someone's just like a food lover, that they really should try to check out?
It's kind of in a similar region, but a little further south, but I really loved even though I didn't stay a long time, I really loved the food in Singapore. I don't know if you got to go to in your Southeast Asia adventures, but there's something about these hawker centers that I absolutely love. It can be a little grungy and grimy, and it's like, you know, not necessarily pristine or anything like that, but like what comes out of these kitchens is just incredible as well. Like one place I remember was this the Hainanese chicken rice.
Yes,
a very, you know what I'm talking about.
Okay, I know exactly what you're talking about.
It's a very simple dish, right? It's like poached chicken on rice. You know, that's kind of the base of it, right?
Yes.
But I don't know if I have ever, like, I've been seeking and testing Hainanese chicken around the world wherever I can, and you know, Chinese restaurants, let's say, and it's just none of them have come close to ever. I think it was Maxwell Hawker Center that I went to.
I've been to the exact one. I know which one you're talking about. Yes.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Like I dream about it to this day. But yeah, when I was thinking about that, I was like, yeah, I think Singapore for sure. Maybe unexpected for some, but yeah, this is incredible food out of Singapore.
I would agree with the Hainanese chicken rice. It is. It really looks kind of bland, and it looks like something that you would eat if you had like a stomach ache, you know, something that's, you know, like bland and simple and nothing too crazy. And then you take a bite, even just the rice, you're just like, what just happened? Like, is this real? Like, am I actually like eating what I think I'm eating? Doesn't like the way it tastes doesn't match the way it looks. And with the hawker stalls, it's so cool. Cause yeah, you can just like hop around. And it's very inexpensive. Singapore is a pretty expensive city for food in a lot of ways. And when my wife and I went there, it was on the tail end of our trip. So our budget was just a little bit smaller. And we ate almost exclusively just eating at different hawker centers around Singapore. And goodness, like, even though it's some of the same dishes, every single stall is different. They all have their own style. They all taste a little bit different. And they're all like US dollars was, I don't know, $2-3
cheap,
something, you know, for a dish. And then you just kind of make your own feast a little bit, kind of like an all you can eat buffet situation where you go and you eat this until you're done. And then you go try something else. And then you go try something else. And then you go try something else and you eat till you're full and you only spent like $10. I think it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and for your audience that hasn't heard of a hawker center before, I mean, it's really just kind of a glorified food court.
Yes.
It's, you know, if you're thinking about how it is in North America, but I mean, I guess it's like a cross between a food court and like food trucks, I guess is the best way to go about it.
That's a really good way to put it.
Yeah, yeah. And some of these businesses have been around for like decades, right? Like they're established and everyone knows, all the locals know that place is the best, you know, whatever it is. It could be laksa or, you know, Hainanese chicken or, you know, some sort of dessert or boba, like bubble tea. You could find so many different types of cuisines. And I think Singapore is interesting because it being kind of a hub within Southeast Asia, like there's so many influences from the entire region. So you get, you know, food from all over Asia there. You're kind of all in one spot, which is really fun.
Singapore is one of the cities where I don't think I had a single bad meal at all. Just everything I ate was amazing. It was inexpensive. And I just had a good time. Everyone's pretty nice. It's neat, clean, and orderly. I tell people, if you're going to visit, you know, Asia, and you're kind of concerned about, you know, the adaptation for the language and the culture differences, and you're maybe hesitant because there's just a lot of fear and anxiety, I'd recommend Singapore, because a lot of people, at least for North America, and Americans in general, like they speak English. Almost everyone speaks English. Like there's, goodness, I think 6 native languages in Singapore or something like that. But everyone's really nice. It's clean. You don't have to worry about getting sick from the food. And for the most part, you can get around and speak English and be in a really good spot. So Singapore, delicious, delicious food for sure.
Yeah, highly recommended.
All right. So talked about some of your favorite food memories here. How about, you mentioned travel hacks before, and I want to touch on this because this is where I've tried to get into it. I've been trying to find my way to get free flights and miles, and sometimes it just didn't work out for me. I don't know why. I've kind of put a stop on trying to get miles for a little while now. So walk us through your process of maybe like travel hacks, getting free flights, credit cards, or some other rewards or point systems, because I'm actually very, very new and still a little bit skeptical.
Yeah, I can totally understand. It's a very complex world of travel hacking, and I think what makes it hard is that there are levels to it. You know, the kind of the more casual collector of points, and then you have people that, you know, kind of go all out and you know, border gray line type of activities, let's just say. But I would say for folks that are really trying to start travel hacking, I think this really does apply cross border, so US and Canada. The way I've really done it is kind of through credit cards and those sign-up bonuses. So I think it seems daunting because, like, oh my gosh, I got to spend a lot of money to get points and it's going to take years to collect it. While that's true, it's really those huge sign-up bonuses that I see in the US credit cards all the time. In Canada, we have them as well. That's where you get, like, you know, your 50,000, 70,000 points that would have taken a lot of money spending, to get to that level, but you kind of get it all in one shot. So if you're very strategic in those signups, and this could mean a multiple signup of cards, maybe your wife signs up for one, you sign up for one, you stagger it a bit, or you get different collection of cards that kind of all contribute to a similar program, or same program rather, that's when you start seeing your balance grow. And it really is about focusing on one thing or two things. Let's say we're talking about just flights. The move that you should kind of make and decide on at the beginning is like, okay, I'm going to be with United, and so that's all I'm going to be focusing on. Or maybe it's Alaska Airlines. That's going to be a really program for you. Now you can dissect each one and, you know, try to figure out which one's the best one. And I think a lot of it may depend on where you live and what your closest hub airport is. Like, let's say you live in Chicago, that's very much a United hub. So that's Star Alliance. And so, yes, there's some research and work that needs to be done to kind of understand that a little bit more, the nuances of the different programs and the alliances. But once you have that, once you have a really nice foundation of points, then it's time to spend it. And I think one mistake that some folks make is like using the points to redeem for, you know, like a gift card, or using those points to redeem for, you know, something from, you know, Best Buy, or, you know, getting a TV. And while the conversions for those it'll be pretty awesome that you can get, you know, spend your points on those things, like getting a new TV. The conversion of points to dollar is typically much worse. And so the true value of your points is, without getting too deep into all this, the true value of these points is to essentially convert them to flights, right? And yes, it can get pretty complicated at this point. I won't go into all the details, but it's trying to find. So in the sweet spot back in the day was to figure out where I could spend the points that, one, were between airports that didn't have a lot of taxes and fees. So within Asia is awesome. Or could you use the points to do a really complicated itinerary? So for us, okay. I was able to, with Air Canada, fly from Dulles to Johannesburg to Cape Town to Seychelles via Ethiopia, and then Seychelles back to Dulles in Washington. And that was all on one ticket. And that was, you know, let's say 90,000 points per person, which is like international redemption, but I was able to squeeze all that in. So you're literally squeezing every single, as much as you can out of these flights, and having the maximum number of stopovers, and you're really finessing the system as it was designed to do. But because, you know, you know what the possibilities are, you've done the research, those are some of the possibilities. And so that's what some of the travel hackers talk about. Like, and then there's some people that say like only use the points on business class. And so I'm on the fence with that. I've certainly used a lot of my points for just economy class tickets because I didn't have enough points. But yeah, people say that if you spend it on like the Singapore Airlines, you know, the suites, going from, let's say, New York City all the way to Singapore, a really long flight. And if you're able to get a business class ticket on, you know, whatever amount of points that is, if you convert that to dollars, if you were to pay for it, that's where you're getting the true bang for buck. And travel hackers get really obsessed over like dollars, dollars per points per percents or points per dollar kind of thing, conversions. I am just about like, I get to go where I want to, and I can really do some really interesting itineraries based on those points. But yeah, that's a little bit of a glimpse of how it works.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have any sort of links that you've written about that I can post on the show notes of the page so that our readers can maybe read a little bit more into it?
Yeah, I do. I do. I'll share some with you. Some of them are a bit dated because Aeroplan, which is kind of the Air Canada loyalty program, has changed. That's since okay. I was able to pull off, you know, the South Africa Seychelles trip, but it kind of gives you an idea of like what the thought processes were and understanding the rules and things like that, what it takes.
So just to sum up, it's just to simplify it a little bit too. So you want to pick one program of certain rewards. So if whether it's flights or hotels, you want to make sure you pick one type of reward and focus in on that with one type of rewards card and focus all of your spending and activity and understanding it on that one sort of rewards program. Is that right?
Yep. That's absolutely
okay. Correct. Yeah. So, and that's different for everybody, just like you mentioned, because, you know, if you're in Chicago, you got to see which ones are give you the best flights out of Chicago and focus on one of those major airlines. And I like the flight aspect a little bit more than like hotels as far as spending rewards, because I like Airbnbs, and sometimes, you know, I don't want to spend all my time in Marriott's or in Hyatt's or, you know, those sort of hotel chains all the time. I kind of want some diversity and a little bit of different experiences when I travel. So I think the flights, I'm going to look into it and see if that might be an option for us to get some free flights this year, because I could definitely use it planning a trip through like Central and South America for 2022, the summer and fall and winter time. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, totally possible. If you put your mind to it and you start really focusing, not just spend, but just think about like, okay, what kind of sign-up bonuses you can take advantage of. And before you know it, you're going to have enough to get a free flight. So
boom.
Yeah, it's yeah. pretty sweet.
Yeah. And to kind of close up a few things, the life of travel, people look at it and they see it as some sort of distant dream and fantasy. And sometimes it doesn't have to be a whole life dedicated to travel. Sometimes you can just spend a few weeks, a month or 2 months even on a trip. And just from what you've talked about, spending, you know, 4 months in school abroad changed your life. And then spending and planning, you know, a few months in Asia, you know, really changed the direction of your life too. So for people who might be in like a normal job situation like you were, or maybe someone who just has like a normal 9-to-5, do you think that that person can organize and find a way to maybe spend like a month traveling abroad? And how could they do that?
I think it's definitely possible. I mean, like I'm drawing upon my experiences in my previous life as a consultant working for a software company. Yeah, I had totally had that kind of 9-to-5 lifestyle. But I always made sure to incorporate trips into the year. So a lot of it comes down to early planning. So not procrastinating about it. But starting whenever it kind of makes sense, like thinking 6 months out, maybe it's 8 months out about a trip that you might potentially want to do. You need to almost put it in action so that you can start thinking about it. You can really make it happen. You know, whether it's planning or getting friends involved or family to figure out who's going to be able to go with you, the finances, all those things. If you don't start, it's just never really going to happen. It's part of like a mindset thing, right? The other part, I think from a work perspective, logistically, it's about one, maybe seeding those ideas to, let's say, your manager, or more strategically start thinking about like, how can I rearrange those vacation days to make it work? Thinking about like spillover, basically vacation days that you might not have used the previous year, forgetting the term right now. But yeah, reallocating all those and seeing if like, okay, can I actually clump, you know, all these together to make like a 1 month trip work? And then think about like which are the months that work best in your job where it's not super disruptive, or like you can get somebody to cover you. There's a lot of different of those elements involved. But I think the core of it's like, start thinking early, start planning. And the pieces will start coming together, but it's totally possible. I know it's a different situation for everyone, with work and whatnot. But yeah, if you make it a goal for your year to go do it, most likely it's going to happen.
Yeah. I know so many people who've never actually had more than a week and a half off from work in a single time. And I was one of those people. From the time I was 16, was able to work, you know, I have worked and done school and worked, and goodness, I didn't have any sort of extended time off. And I thought it was kind of like a joke when people said, yeah, I took a month off. Like, what are you talking about? I remember the first time it really kind of came into effect. I was a car salesman, and I was talking to this customer who walked on the lot, and we were just kind of chit-chatting about things, getting to know each other. And he said, yeah, I just got back from the Canary Islands, and I've been there for the past year. And I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, I was there for the past year. Like, how is that even possible? Like, what do you mean? You're there for a whole year? And I asked, how'd you do that? He goes, well, I just went. I'm like, that was the stupidest thing he could have ever said to me. But now I'm thinking back to him, like, you know what? That was probably the perfect answer. Like I just went, like I just did it, you know? And for people who are struggling for maybe a little bit of time off, you know, you hit the nail on the head, you know, you have to start planning ahead a little bit, start planting those seeds with your boss and trying to figure out the logistics. And if you don't start doing that, if you think of it as just like a distant fantasy, it's never going to happen for yourself. You're never going to have those life-changing experiences. Because I don't think someone can go and travel for a month and not come out extremely well, I guess, changed at the end in the positive way, you know, and have their entire perspective kind of flipped on its head, especially if you haven't really done that much traveling before.
Yeah. And another thing that just kind of popped to my head was just kind of the new dynamics of work with the pandemic and just kind of how things have been going with remote work. If it's possible, there are certainly creative ways to kind of make it work, right? Working remotely. There's so many different ways you can do it. I mean, being connected to so much is easier than ever before. And so, yeah, I've seen people be able to do that, you know, take a couple weeks to work remotely in, you know, a place they want to go visit and then take vacation afterwards or do something like that. There's so many kind of creative approaches to it for sure.
Yeah, definitely get creative because you only live once. You don't know when you're going to die, you know, and I hate commercials a lot, but somehow I think it was on YouTube or maybe on like Hulu. I was just streaming something and this commercial popped up and it had Ewan McGregor on there. And he's walking through like the studio and he starts talking about stuff. Like, we like stuff. Stuff is great. You know, stuff makes us feel good and stuff has, you know, good value to us. But when you're dying, are you going to regret not having more stuff? And it was from Expedia. I'm like, wow, actually that makes a lot of sense. Like, we spend a lot of money and time on buying stuff and less time and money on experiences. So, hey, commercials, but man, that one hit home for me. I'm like, yes, we got to travel more. We got to travel more for sure.
That's a good one. Oh, and if I could just throw in one more thing in there.
Oh yeah, please do.
When I worked for a tech company, they had kind of a lot of companies are going with this now, kind of the concept of open vacation days. Basically, as an employee, you don't have the fixed, you know, 2 week vacation days, or, you know, you have 3 weeks or maybe just 1 week. But it's just take however many you want. And sounds amazing, right? But if you look at the numbers, a lot of people don't get to take advantage. And that's because they're not actively thinking about going on vacation. It slips their mind. Mm-hmm. The year goes on and it's like, oh, I guess you only use one day of unlimited vacation days technically. I certainly took advantage of that when I was there, but I knew so many people that just didn't really go anywhere. I just continued to work. So it kind of goes back to the idea of like, okay, you just got to do it. You got to start thinking about it and planning for it. But very strategic on some of these companies. These unlimited vacation days are actually beneficial for the company because I think a lot of people don't actually use them.
So use the vacation days, especially if they're open like that.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Use them. Yeah. Even if it's not unlimited, don't let them go to waste. I mean, like, they're for you to use. So don't let them roll over lose them completely.
So from your travels, have you ever like made any big mistakes or have any big regrets? I'm not sure if you got scammed or if, you know, you lost something that was really, really important, or maybe you didn't spend enough time doing something you should have.
Ooh, well, yeah, I've definitely been scammed. Definitely had things stolen.
Yeah,
I've gone through all of those. There was good old switcher. Okay. So this is in Istanbul. And we were taking a taxi to one of the Turkish bathhouses, and, you know, from our, you know, hotel. And, you know, was super friendly, drove really fast, but was super friendly. And, you know, we got to our supposed end destination. And, you know, kind of being unfamiliar with the cash, you know, we were trying to figure out how we were going to pay him. It's always awkward, right? It's not Uber. So you got to count it out, like figure out the tips and all those things. But we basically handed him like, I think it was like a 50 lira bill. And is this old switcheroo trick where he then, what really happens is that he switches it to a different bill and says like, hey, you're short. I think you showed us like a 10 or something like that. And we're like, what? No, we just gave you 50. So this is the first time this has happened. I've heard about this trick in South America. I didn't expect it to happen in Turkey, but, you know, I've heard stories in Istanbul as well, but it was like, oh my gosh, this has happened to us. But yeah, we argued about it. We yelled at him, and eventually we're like, no, we're not going to give you any more money. We had to kind of cut our losses a little bit. Like, we were expecting some money back, but like, he was insistent that like, we still owed him more money. We're like, no, that's what we owe you. And then we just walked away.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was a learning experience for us. Like, you know, as I think the funny thing with that story is that, like, you know, this only happened a couple of years ago. And as much as like seasoned, quote unquote, travelers we are, like, stuff will still happen, right? Like, we're smarter travelers for sure and more savvy, but there'll still be moments where like, you'll either have a brain fart or like, you're just unlucky, right? Like, somebody's out there to scam you. They're going to figure out a way to scam you, right? So luckily we weren't, I think our minds were sharp enough to go like, what? No, we definitely gave you this other bill. What's going on? Right. And like, oh my gosh, this guy's trying to trick us. Right. But still, like, yeah, that's I guess one example of many things that have happened over the years.
Yeah. I'm glad that you mentioned, no matter how seasoned you are, it's going to happen sometimes.
It happens to the best of us.
Yeah. It happens to me too. Like, even on this, my goodness, last year, sometime this is actually in Istanbul as well. Not that Istanbul is full of scammers, but this happened in Istanbul and it was actually very creative. This is the one of the most creative ones I've seen, where we're just walking across the, the main bridge from one part of the city to the other one, you know, the Galata Bridge, I think that's what it's called. Yes. Or something. And we're walking behind this guy who was a shoe shiner. He had picked up his stuff and he started walking, and we just happened to be right behind him. So he drops one of his brushes and it drops on the ground. So I pick it up and I run. I just kind of walk faster and I go up to him. Hey, you dropped your brush. He spoke very little English, but he goes, oh, thank you so much. Oh, thank you. I really appreciate this. Here, let me just shine your shoes real quick as a thank you. I'm like, no, that's fine. You don't have to do that. So he's like, no, I insist. So I had like these leather shoes on and he cleans the shoes for me. And my wife's there too, and he cleans her shoes too. It's like, okay, I just want to thank you so much. And he goes, okay, that'll be, like 40 lira or whatever. I'm like, what? And I can't remember the exact amount, but it basically equated out to like 12 US dollars, which is a lot of money. Goodness, like, what he asked us for in money could have bought us like both a really nice meal in Istanbul and for a shoe shine. And I've had other shoe shine people come up to me and be like, you know, just a couple lira for a shoe shine. And so then I'm like, no, like, we're not giving you any money. And he starts like screaming and yelling at us. I'm like, okay, I'm going to give you 5 lira and that's it. And like, you can just like move on. And he's like, I'm going to get the police. I'm like, okay, that's fine. And we just started walking. We walked away, but I'm like, goodness, like he has got a shoe shine from us for like, what in the world? What just happened? And unfortunately it can just sneak up on you. So that's travel sometimes, and it makes for some interesting stories for sure.
Yeah. And it always starts in your story, it started off with good intentions, right?
And
it comes back to bite you sometimes, but that's good. That's a good one to know. I'll put that, you know, I'll put that in the catalog of things to watch out for.
All right. One last question here to round out the interview. What is the number one bucket list trip that you have that you would take if money wasn't an option?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot on that list of things that I want to do. I think the biggest one, and because you say money is no object, would probably be something like one of those 1 month expeditions in the Antarctic to see the king penguins, then be able to see the various you know, colonies and icebergs and the entire kind of Antarctic landscape. That's something that I've always wanted to do.
Yeah, that truly is an expedition. It is so much money.
it's very expensive. And that's why I was like, there are a lot of things that I want to do that, you know, could probably make happen down the road, but I'm like, I don't know if I could ever afford that, you know, 23-day, like, you know, $20,000-$30,000 trip. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Will, thank you so much for coming on the show, telling us about your adventures and plenty of advice. If people want to like follow you and keep up with everything that you're doing, what's the best way for them to do that?
So Going Awesome Places is kind of where you'll find me all over, whether that's on Instagram, on Facebook, Twitter. Twitter is a little bit shortened, so that's Go Awesome Places, but everywhere else it's like Going Awesome Places. The blog itself, which is where I got my start and continue to write today is on goingawesomeplaces.com. And same thing on YouTube. So if you look up Going Awesome Places, I'll show up there.
Yes, you should be going to Tokyo. And yes, you should be going to Singapore and eating your weight in noodles and chicken and everything else in between. I love hearing Will's perspective on traveling, and his advice was really well received, especially by me, because I'm always trying to find ways to extend my travels to save money and just have the best time possible. And I think I will try to give this whole travel hacking a bit of a start and seeing where I can come up with free points and free flights, trying to make the most of my money when I can. So we're budget travelers. We don't have a ton of money. So when we can save a few pennies here and there and find ways to, I guess, cut our travel costs down, I'm going to do it. And I'm going to put that money most likely towards food. Of course, you guys know me. So definitely go to the show notes of this episode where Will has given me some links that he thinks will be very beneficial to all of you, including the travel hacks. Go to nomadicfoodist.com/episode30. That's nomadicfoodist.com/episode30 for the show notes on this page. Links to all of the things that we talked about, as well as all the social media, so you can follow Will and his adventures around the world. If you like this episode, please hit that follow button so that you get a new interview every single week with an amazing traveler and foodist who wants to share their experiences with you and give you some advice and tips so that you can have the best vacation, the best travel experiences possible. Thank you again for listening, and remember, eat with an adventurous heart no matter where you go.